Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to the ChrisMartinson.com podcast. I'm your host, of course, Chris Martinson. And today we're going to take a quick detour back over into Europe because, as you know, I just wrote a report talking about how this might be 2008 all over again. And, of course, what I'm looking at in that report is the deterioration that I'm seeing across Europe, thinking of Europe as a potential trigger point for a liquidity crisis, whereas last time it was an institutional liquidity crisis centered around some dodgy debts that went bad and some derivatives thereupon that made it worse. This time, similar dynamic, of course, different players, different sort of a focus. Maybe it's happening in the sovereign debt side. And so here to discuss that with us is our very own Alistair MacLeod, who has penned a couple of nice pieces for us and is sitting over in Europe. Welcome, Alistair.
Thank you, Chris.
Oh, so happy to have you again. And I know describing you as our very own was a stretch, but I like to think that we've got a nice relationship going.
It's nice to be part of the family.
Thank you for that. So here's the situation. Right? Greece has elected a new government comprised of more powerful elements from both the left and the right, neither of which seems to have any interest, apparently, in honoring the prior bailout and or austerity agreements. Spain seems to be under increasing fire. Its banks were rudely downgraded recently by the ratings agencies. And Bankia specifically seems to be needing some help right here. Maybe has already experienced something of a bank run of sorts, maybe, if we're reading between the lines right. GDP in Spain just announced was dropped 0.3% in the first quarter. So that confirms a return to recession there for Spain, I believe. Let's go to Italy. 26 large and medium banks just downgraded recently. GDP just announced contracted by 0.8% through the first 3 months of the year. That would give it its fourth recession since 2001, now pretty much in the bag. What is going on over there?
Well, I think you've actually described it pretty well. Every horror you can imagine and that we discussed last time we spoke about this is really, I'm afraid, coming about. The Greek situation is entirely predictable. When you force enormous pressures on an economy and try and raise taxes from the private sector, which isn't used to paying taxes, incidentally, because usually they find a way around it,
mm-hmm.
You start cutting pensions, you start cutting this, cutting that. You know, the people revolt. And, I mean, they haven't a clue what they're doing, but we get the revolt nonetheless. And it looks like nobody can form a government, and it looks like there'll be another election there, and that will be probably in June. That won't resolve anything unless by some miracle some sense gets knocked into people's heads. I don't know. I wouldn't like to say get knocked into people's heads because that might imply violence, which actually may not be too far beneath the surface in this one. No, it's not good. And the French election with Hollande getting in basically tells us that the pressure is going to be to not go for so much austerity. So some sort of new middle way will have to be found, not just there, but I think round Europe, which implies that the Germans are going to have to give a bit. And, you know, I know it's not a fashionable thing to say, but I feel quite sorry for the Germans because it's their savings that are being chucked as good money after bad. So that's a mess, and I think that, I mean, the Spanish situation suddenly comes upon us. The yields, I don't think, have quite reflected this yet. I think they're only about, 6.5% or something.
Yeah, that's about
the
right.
Yields should be north of 10, I think, the way this is going. So we will see higher yields, which will equate to a turn of the screw on the rack. And Italy, as you point out, things are not going so well there. I mean, the whole thing is a nightmare. I think the only thing I can say about this nightmare is that the overall debt situation is not quite as bad as America.
Well, so.
But that's small comfort and actually causes further thoughts which might make you reach for the whiskey bottle, if you like.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, really, Chris, I think all this is really coming to pass as we discussed.
Yeah.
And bank runs, I mean, certainly, the Spanish situation to have, I mean, we know that the Greek banks have had a run on them. We know also that the Spanish banks have had a sort of run, because this has been reflected in Target 2. I mean, the Target 2 imbalances are reflecting as much as anything capital flight. And that's built up quite rapidly over the last 2 or 3 years, and it's the build-up has been accelerating, as we discussed the other week. So that's where we are. It's at least as bad as we said, and I think it's at least as bad as you read, and probably even worse.
Right. So let's unpack this a little, because the real question I'm interested in addressing is, well, what happens next? How does this unfold? I've read everything from, let's just focus it down to Greece for a minute. So Greece leaves the euro. I've read everything from William Buiter said, that's it. It's all over. You can just put a fork in the Greek banking system. It'll be an immediate run and collapse. They will not be able to get financing. It will just be a complete horrid mess. Losses for everyone. To other people, so other analysts who sort of toss their hands up and suggest, well, it'll be a little rough, but maybe not all, and uncertain, but they'll get through it. So what's the mechanism here? A lot of moving pieces. Let's start here. We've heard about Greek bank withdrawals, people presumably finally waking up and yanking their money out of their banks. I presume either if they can't get their hands on cash, that means they're pulling it out of one bank, it's going into another. I'm going to have to guess some of those banks are probably outside of Greece. Otherwise, why would you pull your money from a Greek bank other than to avoid the potential losses that might come if Greece does decide to go with the drachma and does some sort of a revaluation, which by definition, of course, will result in losses for anybody who's an enforced part of that conversion. So,
yeah.
So is that part of the mechanism here? We're having, banks only have, first of all, they're fractional reserve banks like banks everywhere. So yes, they have nominally a bunch of assets on the books and a bunch of liabilities and they match roughly. But when people are pulling money out, there can be an extraordinary mismatch developing because, of course, the loans are locked into fairly longish terms and the cash has to be, produced on demand.
Yes.
For now, the ECB has said, we'll help you through that process. But there are concerns now that maybe the ECB is saying, we won't even help you with that. I don't even remotely understand how a bank survives that, but what are you seeing in this mechanism? Is that about what's happening here?
Well, let me first, your last point first. Let's just address the ECB. The ECB can counteract any bank runs for banks within the euro system, but it cannot recapitalize banks. That is down to individual governments working with their own national central banks. So therefore, ensuring liquidity is available is a short-term fix, while more permanent arrangements are being put in place. Unfortunately, we don't see the more permanent arrangements being put in place. So that's the sort of, where the ECB is and why it has got a problem. It just can't continue to chuck money at keeping these banks afloat forever. There's got to be, if you like, an exit plan. If we look at Greece, a lot of money has left Greece. The estimates I've seen is that roughly 72 billion in deposits has disappeared out of the Greek banking system over the last 2 or 3 years. And that must have been accelerating in the last month or two. And if you look at the Bank for International Settlements figures, at the end of 2011, Greece's banks had foreign assets of 195 billion and liabilities of 103 billion. So that's indicative of the amount of money, if you like, that has gone out into bank, because normally you would expect those two figures to more or less balance.
Right.
Because if you're running a bank, you do try and put that sort of discipline into your balance sheet, and the Greeks would have done that as bankers anyway. So the shortfall, basically, between those two is an indication of the stress that the banking system in Greece feels. And so, that indicates about half the foreign position has been unwound, but as you rightly make the point, while the foreigners can maybe unwind their positions as much as possible in the Greek, in terms of Greek exposure, it's not necessarily so easy for the Greek banks to do the same. And indeed, they won't have quite the same motivation to do the same. So the cash withdrawals that are going on at the moment are against a background of balance sheets which are already very, very badly skewed. So the thing is really quite nasty there. Now, the other thing which nobody has mentioned is that there are about $90 billion in derivative contracts involved in the Greek economy. I mean, this is not just government, but also, sort of local governments and towns and cities and all the rest of it. And the counterparties to $90 billion must be getting a bit worried about that, I'd think, because that looks as if that will default. So that's something that's got to be caught worldwide. And the people who have been most active in getting these derivative contracts going over time have been people like Deutsche Bank, Goldman Sachs, and I suppose JP Morgan, I don't know. But anyway, so you can see that, you know, the problems aren't just limited to the government and, you know, some sort of unfortunate Greek citizens who are caught in the middle of this.
Right. So let me take one point, little diversion here. There's a lot of confusion around derivatives and how they operate. And many times I hear it, and sometimes even I talk about it this way, that in large measure, a lot of derivative contracts are a zero-sum game. These are the things that JP Morgan just got caught up in, right? So you and I might decide to exchange $1 billion credit default swap with each other, and neither of us owns the underlying. At the end of the day, that zeroes out. My loss is your gain, or vice versa. But where this doesn't zero out is if I actually am holding the underlying, I have Greek debt, I have $1 billion worth of it, and what I want to do is protect that, and you decide to go ahead and insure that for me, so you do a credit default swap with me, you issue it, I buy it, right? I pay you some rate, let's call it, you know, 7%, 700 basis points on that. And but then the underlying goes poof, right? That $1 billion actually goes away, I want to be made whole on that, you now owe me that $1 billion in when the underlying actually goes sour, those losses are very real, and the derivatives are the armature. They're the mechanism by which those losses get pushed out into the system. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. We're looking at potentially up to $90 billion worth of derivatives, which one side of those transactions is going to default. One side. It's not a balance figure, is it? So you're absolutely right in pointing that out. I don't know that it's necessarily as bad as that, but it's a problem that needs to be dealt with, addressed and contained. So I think that what they've got to do as much as possible is to try and work for a sensible outcome in this, which probably will involve Greece leaving the Eurozone, but maybe obtaining help from the ECB to set up a currency board. Now, the reason I say that is that I think for Greece to return to a drachma would be complete destruction. You would have a situation where people who owe money in euros would still owe money in euros. If the Greek government tried to change that by law, for a start, that could only apply to loans taken out in euros in Greece, whereas a lot of these will have been taken out in euros elsewhere in the European Union. And in any event, I think if they tried to do a law on this, it would be a retrospective, which, you know, would be open, I think, to legal challenge. Meanwhile, if you've got deposits in a Greek bank, you can be pretty sure that the Greek government would say, right, we're going to redesignate those into new drachmas, which basically would impoverish the depositors. And when it comes to trade, I think everybody would just stay well clear. I mean, To go back to a new drachma, I think, is the most destructive path Greece can have. Now, they could do that on the basis that if the European Union wanted to make an example of Greece, then this is a way in which they could just let them go hang. Now, the importance of that would be that the situation for Greece should be so bad that no other member of the Eurozone would contemplate leaving the Eurozone. That is a possibility, but I think that's less likely than coming to terms in such a way to give Greece an exit. But if they do get an exit, they've got to have an exit in such a way that it hurts enough, and anybody else who wants to take that exit will see, well, you know, it's actually probably more painful than staying where we are. It's a very difficult balance to achieve. The people who will do this, I don't believe, are the politicians. It would have to be the sensible people in the ECB and perhaps some of the more backroom boys who could put together some sort of face-saving mechanism without this becoming too much of a political hot potato. It's very, very tricky, Chris. It really is. And quite honestly, the way political governance has been going in Europe, the chances of them getting some sort of orderly withdrawal in the interest of continuing relationships, etc., etc., I think actually are probably slim odds against. But that's what we're up against. This is not easy. There's no precedent for this at all. And I know that lots and lots of people are saying, that it's got to return to the drachma. And you wrote, I thought, quite a well-argued piece, sort of going in those lines. But I just think that a new drachma would collapse almost immediately. And I think that a currency board and the euro is actually a more sensible result given where we are. But in order for that to happen, Greece would have to have the euros, if you like, to back its own currency issuance. And then it would have to run it properly. So, you know, everything would have to be put in place that this would actually work. But I don't know anyone thinking this way. This is the other trouble.
Well, the only other thing I could think about would be some sort of a jubilee where the ECB just sort of pays off Greek's debts and says, okay, let's sort of start over here, I guess. As I read it right now, if Greece does fully exit the euro and then says punts on all of its external liabilities, there's still $350 billion of losses lurking out there potentially.
Yes, that's right. It's
quite a large number. And so, as you say, you know, the contagion fear is the one where if Greece gets away with it and Spain looks over and says, well, that seems easier, you know, than trying to pay all these things off, they might do that too.
Yes, that's right. And in Spain, I mean, you're looking like it's a worse situation. I mean, government debt alone is just under a trillion dollars equivalent, I should say. And that's a lot of money. That's a lot of money. Italy is over $2 trillion. That really is a very, very big one. So this contagion mustn't be allowed to happen. And, you know, I just don't know how this is going to pan out. I can't see where the exit, I can't see where the happy ending is in this. This is the problem.
Right. Well, so let's talk about that for a second, because you mentioned, so Holland gets elected in, and so there's this general anti-austerity fervor in the political elections going on, if we can interpret it that way. But what really could Holland or anybody really do to say, I'm off of the path of austerity, besides engage in deficit spending at the government level, but they still have to fund that in the bond markets in some way, shape, or form. They don't have their own printing presses. They don't have a compliant Fed over there monetizing their sovereign debt to the tune of 61% of on-the-run issuance or anything lovely like that. Where and how would they even fund the opposite of austerity if it was their political desire to do so?
I think this is you've come up to the nub of it, of the story, because the answer is that it can only be provided by an easier money policy from the ECB. And in order to achieve that, there's got to be some very serious arguments, if you like, between the Bundesbank, representing the Germans in terms of monetary policy, and the ECB itself. And I see no alternative to an outcome where there is a far more expansionary policy. I mean, not quite... I don't know, it might be quantitative easing, but I think it's probably more likely that the ECB would be given a lot more firepower to try and keep the banking system going, and through the banking system, the banks allowed to lend to the governments and to, if you like, buy more debt to pay for the redemptions, you know, so that the rollovers can continue. And now here's something which I think does become quite important, and that is that this explains, I think, a little bit of the weakness that we've seen in the euro in the last week, and it would justify yet more weakness in the euro. So I would see the euro going down quite a bit on this. I think that's a likely outcome.
Interesting. Well, I'm gonna propose that instead of LTRO3, that the ECB promote the HMSPs. That's the Hail Mary Speculative Purchase Program. And they should just issue a trillion, which can be put into Facebook stock. I think that would solve a lot right here.
Yeah. Well, as a speculative proposition, it's a lot less speculative than chucking it at Spain and Greece, perhaps.
You might be right. Oops.
Anyway, that's we mustn't joke, actually, because it is an extremely serious situation.
Well, it is. And the question, of course, is how does this all unfold? And so I hear you describing that there are a lot of political difficulties and realities, all of which imply there's a certain pace at which these potential solutions can be proposed, vetted, worked through the system. It's my sense that perhaps events are running a bit faster than that process can engage. Do you share that view?
Yes, I would agree with you entirely. It's as so often happens in these things, they start off slowly and the pace sort of quickens. It's almost like it goes sort of at an exponential growth rate, if you could chart events as such. I think that this is going to now accelerate very rapidly. There is one possible outcome, and that is if Greece leaves and they manage to work out sensible terms on the sort of lines perhaps that I just suggested just now, then there may be a recovery in the markets, a sort of sigh of relief, if you like. But I don't think I would put money on it. You know, it's sort of rather like betting on how far a dead cat might bounce. But we might get a little bit of a pause in the increasing pace of events. But basically, it would be a pause, and I think it would only be a matter of a very short time before things start deteriorating again. You cannot have the banks getting into such difficulties without really very, very adverse consequences. And unless the ECB comes in very quickly and somehow manages to nip that in the bud, and ideally, as I've said before, you know, if you can get governments perhaps to, you know, face up to the fact that they are spending more than they attract in income tax and can borrow in the markets and actually do something about that, at least keep the banks going, then that is probably about the only way out. But I have to say the politicians are showing great reluctance to face up to reality of any sort. And they have the problem, of course, that as they do that, their people just chuck them out of office. So it's a very, very difficult situation.
Well, I suppose that, you know, there's I've read a number of commentators who've asked what I think is a very logical question, which was instead of feeding funds to banks and hoping that they would do the right things with it, of course, they don't know what to do with it. Growth is not part of the equation right now. So the normal credit mechanisms aren't operating quite the same. I think it was quite obvious to me that our credit markets after a sustained 40-year bubble were probably going to be moribund for a period of time, but Japan in the 80s through the 90s could have taught you the same lesson. So it's confusing that the authorities gave, both in the US and in the UK, and following Japan's model, I believe, gave one toss at this, which is, well, let's just make credit and liquidity very easy for the banks and cross our fingers, close our eyes, hope for the best. When there's another strain of thought which said, well, you know, if the banks were having so much difficulty with bad loans, why didn't you make the funds available to the people? Now, people would have gotten the funds. What would they have done with them? Well, they'd have paid off their debts and put them into the banking system. It would have gone to the banking system anyway, but it would have taken a tour through the populace first, which arguably might have had a different sort of an impact on demand if that's what you were targeting. Not that I'm promoting that would have been a good idea either. I'm just saying it was perplexing what they chose to do, more perplexing that now that it's provably not working, all I hear so far are strains of doing it bigger and better this time. Are you seeing different strains out there?
No, I think you've summed it up right. And there's this sort of extraordinary situation where, for the amount of money that they throw at the problem, you know, you'd think if they just distributed it around the citizens, that it would be a far cheaper solution. But I think the two things that mitigate against that, one is that if you just distribute money around the citizens, then prices go up accordingly for everything very, very rapidly. In other words, it would be instantly inflationary. You distribute it through the banks, then what you're doing is you are doing something that you learned in university, as you read Keynes, was the sort of thing to do to try and rescue an economy from further deterioration. And they're all just actually working off the textbook. If you talk to any central banker about what his worst nightmare is, and he'll tell you it's a debt deflationary collapsing spiral. We're so close to that, they will tell you. That is our nightmare, and we will do everything we possibly can to ensure that that doesn't happen. So that's why they chuck the money at the economy through the banks, because you know, they are worried about assets, and I'm sure that, you know, that's a lot to do with why interest rates are where they are. It's to keep assets from falling over, and therefore the bank's balance sheets from falling over. And that's the way they do it. So it's a combination, I think, of, you know, if you just distribute it through people, you know, sort of gave everybody, helicoptered some money at people, then the inflationary consequences would be certain. But if you go through the banks, you know, you sort of hope that you've got a theoretical solution, which incidentally, as I think you're aware, I believe is no solution at all. I mean, the real problem is that we've built up such malinvestments over the years that the whole system is really falling over. It can't take it anymore. And it's time there was a debt reconciliation. But, you know, that's the end of the Keynesian experiment. That's the trouble.
Right. Right. So as we look forward, I follow a variety of things. What do you think people should be following if they're interested in getting an early read on whether something is developing or breaking or shifting in the story? Are we watching sovereign bond yields? Are we watching credit spreads? Are we parsing the language of the output from the next ECB meetings? What is it that really bears watching here?
I think the clearest indication is yield spreads, because that is what the market is trying to discount. I would also say that in a bear market, which is really what rising yields are, you tend to have investors being positive and yielding to the bad news. In other words, the ability of the market to discount bad news is considerably less than a good market anticipating good news. But, you know, a bear market is always open to nasty surprises. A bull market always discounts the good. If you think in bear market terms, then the yields of today that we see aren't really discounting anything coming up. And as you see those yields rise, that will give you a very, very good barometer of what is actually going on in the, if you like, in the totality of the mess. So that to me would be the thing to really follow.
Well, and unfortunately, that signal has been somewhat degraded in its utility by all the official intervention, the non-economic players, the central banks, stepping in and depressing yields below what the markets would be delivering. I share with you the idea that if the markets were able to, on their own, decide what appropriate yields would be, they would be a lot higher than they currently are.
Actually, Chris, sorry if I can interject just a second.
Sure.
My comment really in this was with respect to the European yield situation.
Well, there too, hasn't the ECB sort of stepped into a variety of Italian-Spanish auctions over time and through its LTRO, didn't it wink-wink say we wouldn't be too upset if you took those funds and parked them in your sovereign debts? Isn't that a lot of what happened in Spain, for instance?
Yes, that is certainly true. I mean, we saw the yields for these governments, government bonds, fall very substantially on the last LTRO, and there was no doubt that the Italian and the Spanish banks and all the rest of it, whether they gave in to pressure from their governments or whether they did it willingly, I think is of no consequence. The fact is that they did it because yields went down. But that is now no longer the situation. Those banks do have money, I guess, on deposit still at the ECB. They're going to need them for their own debt maturities because those aren't going to get rolled easily. And they've also got to have a certain amount of safety net there because the deposits are tending to walk out of the door. So, you know, the banks are now getting very, very limited on this, which should push yields up even more, I would have thought, for their respective governments. So we should see these yields rise in Spain, Italy, Greece. I think we treat it as a special case now. But of course, there are also Portugal and Ireland too, which has sort of gone very, very quiet. And it's gone quiet there, I think, basically because they're out of the headlamps.
Right. Right. So where do we go from here, do you think? Is this just a situation where we watch the yields? Is there a magic point beyond which the situation breaks for Spain? They go Greek, in essence, and we watch things unfold very rapidly. Or,
well, I think that the I mean, the markets tell us that if the yields go over 7%, then it's curtains. Now, whether that's right or not, I honestly don't know. But if the market thinks it, then this is going to be important because everybody is going to watch that. And I think it's only a matter of time, probably fairly short time, before we see yields breach the 7% level. And, I mean, my view is also that one of the more dangerous situations is France itself. I'm not surprised that the socialist has been elected. The socialist, who incidentally is very much part of the establishment, so the compromises that Hollande is going to obtain from Germany and all the rest of it will be, I suppose, broadly acceptable in the context of where we are in Europe, but I think will probably be taken generally quite badly by the markets. I mean, France is a mess. They have outstanding debt of about, I suppose, 1.3 trillion euros, something like that. Their debt to GDP is around about 85-90%, going on 100 quite rapidly. That is a very illiquid, nasty situation. Unemployment's running close to 10%. It's almost impossible to employ anyone in France because the taxes are so high. And do you know the total tax that you pay as an employer more than doubles the salary that you pay an individual? This is absolute craziness. But it's been like that in France for ever and a day. The result is an awful lot of the market is black market. So it's quite hard to find any area in Europe which is free from this mess. I mean, Germany is okay. They're all right in the sense that their economy is performing reasonably well, but it's not performing well because they are doing well in the, you know, for Europe. They're doing well because they're selling most cars and machine tools and everything else to China, to Brazil, to Russia. Africa is a great growth area. Europe, as far as Germany is concerned, is dead. Which, of course, brings us on another question, and that is, why should Germany continue to support, you know, all these bust Europeans? I mean, there's a sort of conscience, if you like, about the last two world wars, but there's going to come a point where that wears pretty thin, I would have thought. Mm-hmm. And the trouble is that it's all very well everyone turning around and saying, well, Germany's got to help, but actually, what they're saying is that Germany's citizens should give up their savings, their hard won savings, to rescue a project which is obviously dead on its feet. I think it's I think Germany really should butt out as soon as possible, and I'm sure that there are an increasing number of businessmen and bankers in Germany who are beginning to feel that way.
I agree, and from my view, I think that the difficulty here is that nobody quite knows how to go about doing this. Politically, obviously, it's a hairball, but just from a financial system standpoint, it's quite tricky, because even if you say, all right, so here's how we start to cleave these things apart, what we've learned through, you know, watching Warren Buffett attempt to unravel the derivatives positions of a single company, or noting that there's still, I think, somewhere in the vicinity of 300,000 derivative contracts still sort of parked around, and they're trying to figure out how to undo them from the Lehman collapse. Right? These things just take time. It's not as simple as it used to be. It's very interconnected. And so the idea here is it might be fashionable to say, well, let's just isolate these things. Let's go back to some sort of Chinese firewall between, you know, these different entities. But that's a very, very difficult prospect. So again, I see the political reality of this as requiring time, patience, care, and I see the events accelerating and going faster, as you might expect on the tail end of a 40-year exponentially growing debt bubble. Those two things are just sort of in collision at this moment. That's kind of how I'm interpreting at this point, and the bottom line summary I have is nobody knows. This is rather uncertain. We're just going to have to watch. It's part of us is just going to have to be a spectator on this, I think.
I think that's right. And, of course, the other side of the German problem is the bank indebtedness on their bank's balance sheets all around Europe. I mean, some of the numbers, you know, which Germany is paid, so far as I'm aware, and my numbers aren't complete, you're looking at about 1.3 trillion euros, something like that, owed to the German banks from around Europe. Admittedly, that's also includes a figure for the UK. But if you look at Spain, they're owed about 178 billion. The Netherlands owe them 167 billion. Now, that's a quality borrower. Italy, about 165 billion. I mean, these, oh, and France, about 210. These are big numbers. And that's just owed to Germany. And then, of course, we've got the Target 2 imbalances, which are, you know, rapidly moving towards three quarters of a trillion euros as well. So, You know, the financial impact on Germany is actually, I think, likely to make them say, well, you know, we don't want to rock the boat unnecessarily here. You know, that's an argument in favor of that. The only thing I feel certain is likely to come out of this from the German end is an increased demand for gold. Because if you think, you know, German citizen, my savings are getting chucked out against, you know, sort of keep all these other countries going. How do I protect myself? I think the only protection they've got is to go back to gold. And the Germans actually are quite naturally keen on gold. So that is an interesting thought.
Right. Well, I if I was over there, A, I wouldn't have my money in certain banks at this particular juncture, and B, I would certainly have as much out of the system as I felt I could prudently hold. That might be 100% in depending on the country I was in. So,
yeah.
I absolutely agree. Because really, if the option here is, on the one hand, we're the ECB, well, we're going to toss our hands up, we give up. We're just going to let the chips fall where they may, and we're facing the utter dissolution of entire countries, political systems, financial institutions. It's chaos. Been down that road before, within living memory. It's not pleasant, you know, but we're going to go it. Or we're going to try this printing thing, which will A, delay things, maybe past the time I'm on the watch of this job, or B, it might turn out, because as far as I can tell, the plan in Europe so far, which is the plan everywhere in this exponential money system we have, is cross our fingers, as long as we can get back to growth, this whole thing will start working itself out. Not that we'll get smart and we'll say, whoo, dodge that bullet, we'll actually work our debts down. What'll happen is growth will return and everybody will go, see, that's how it's supposed to work, and continue accumulating debts at the old faster-than-income pace until it blows up again at some point in the future. I think that we're at that point in the story where enough people have looked into the future and said, and started to ask, in like all good scenario planning, you should always be asking the alternative, you know, where are my assumptions? Where might I have it wrong? And the primary assumption that we will return to growth, being potentially a flawed one, is something that is seeping in. And with that comes the idea that we fundamentally have to do things very, very differently. So far, I haven't seen that seep into the highest policy levels yet in terms of really trying something brand new.
You are absolutely right on that, because ever since the 2008 financial crisis, the Keynesians in charge at the central banks have chucked out money really on the basis that economic recovery will happen, budget deficits will come down, and we'll all be all right. It's the sort of Keynesian textbook response, if you like. But this is getting a very tired story. I mean, here we are now, what, 3 or 4 years later, still no sign of recovery. And as we discussed last time, I mean, the puffing up of GDP by just throwing money into it, it's a money total, don't forget. And there's no new real recovery there. The result is that there are doubts creeping in. And I don't know whether the doubts are at an intellectual level in the Federal Reserve Board, for example, but I can't help but notice that Bernanke seems to be quite reluctant to do forced QE, QE3. You know, he's sitting on his hands a bit there, whereas I'm sure that 2 years ago, in these current circumstances, he would have printed like bilio. But no, they've shot a few bullets. They know their ammunition's running a bit low, and they've achieved absolutely nothing. And I think there's a level of, they're perplexed, if you like. It's the Keynesian thing. It's just not working at all, and they're all very, very confused. It's almost like you can see a sort of cartoon picture of central bankers looking at each other and all asking the same question, what now?
Sure, they've done the rain dance, they shook the rattles, and the skies are still clear. It's not, something's broken. The magic isn't working. It's very confusing, totally perplexing moment here.
Not to you and me, though.
No. This all is fairly predictable, actually.
Exactly.
And so as we go forward, I do believe that is my view that the next round of QE is still all but inevitable. And because this road, they see it has a bifurcation. They only see two paths. I think there are other paths, but I believe they see it as. either we win this or it deflates and we lose this. And so they're not going to lose if at all possible.
No, that's right. But I also think that there are very good practical reasons for QE, and that is that it is the way in which government borrowing is funded.
Yes.
it's as simple as that.
There you go.
And in an election year in America, I think it's a no-brainer, really.
Sure. So it brings us to my favorite topic of where to invest, and I have this conversation a lot. And I still don't see any way out of gold as being a preferred monetary-like or money-like asset, which you can park yourself into while we watch all of this and spectate and speculate as to what's going to happen next. It's just a safe place to hang out until we know where the risks are, who's holding them, and what the next actions are going to be. I really don't know what else to do at this stage.
Well, I'm totally in agreement with you on that one. And people who have gold or silver, I think, have actually had a very rough ride over the last couple of months. And a lot of them are wondering what on earth is going on, because every time you get good news, gold seems to rally along with equities. But every time there's bad news and gold actually should be giving you some protection, it goes down the swanee. I think the problem there is that the whole system is run by people who went to college and were taught Keynesian economics. I mean, in my day, when I first went into the stock market, and I enjoyed that first bull market in gold when it went from $35 to $850, the traders and investment managers were all practical people. They all cut their teeth, all learned their trade the hard way. Some of them had degrees at college, but generally it would have been something like classics or history or something like yeah. that. If they got a degree in economics, they probably would have been, they would have left because they wouldn't have understood it in those days. But now it has changed. Everybody who is employed has a degree, and if they're anything to do with investment strategy or the investment business, it's all economics degrees. And so they have been brainwashed in the Keynesian thing. So this sort of neoclassical approach where, gold is yesterday's story, paper money is the future, they really do believe it. So, but it's the opinions of these people that drive the markets in the short term. The result is that gold and silver have become very, very seriously mispriced. I don't think I've seen a stretch like this that I can remember. I mean, by stretch, I mean difference between perhaps where it should be. And we must be careful not to tell the market what the price should be. But it is so underpriced at a time of enormous systemic stress that I think that when gold and silver snap back into a more sensible, logical valuation relationship with the markets, the move actually could be very, very sharp and quite large. And if gold, let us say, ran up through the 2000 level very quickly, which I think is a very strong possibility, principally because it's been held down so much, that could bring other problems. The central banks, I think, who might have sold gold and not told us about it through the site system, will find that they're embarrassed. I think also that the bullion banks in London, who operate a fractional reserve system with gold in exactly the same way as they do with any paper currency, will be hurt very, very badly on the run. Any shorts, I think, in the futures markets equally could be hurt very, very badly. So we have a situation, I think, where there is a potential for a huge run in gold, and I personally wouldn't be surprised to see it.
I agree with you completely on that one. It's still a subject of great inquiry, discussion, and parsing where we have a community of people trying to figure out what truly is going on. It's in the gold market. It's fairly opaque. We know that there's this stuff called leasing because we read about it in the footnotes of the central bank balance sheets, and because there's a quoted lease rate. It's just really how much and who's got it and where it is. That's a very difficult information to come by in a way in which I find that I can analyze and be comfortable that I know what's really transpired there. And so, of course, that discomfort extends deep into the market to the point that the people of Germany said, you know, about all that gold that we allegedly have that the Fed's holding for us?
Yes.
Maybe we should just bring that home.
Exactly. And in fact, I don't know if you noticed, but the Bundesbank did actually release some statistics as to where their, or they released a statement about where their gold was being held. And I've been traveling recently, so I'm not totally up to date on that, but I know some of it is in the Bank of England, some of it is at the Fed. And there was a third bank, I think it might have been the Banque de France. And what was not clear to me is whether this was held in what they call an earmarked account, in other words, held at those banks, segregated out as the Bundesbank's own assets, or whether they were held in sight accounts, in other words, just sort of part of the dealing mix, the stock of bullion that they hold in the basement of the Fed or the Bank of England, which they're free to use at any time they see fit. But meanwhile, there's a diary note that they owe this to the Bundesbank. Of course, that's the way they sell gold into the market without having to account for it. It's not just the leasing, it's the operation of the sight accounts. And that, I think, could mean that central bank ownership amongst the central banks of the advanced economies could be as little as half of what's stated, quite easily. We don't know because, as you say, there are absolutely no statistics released on this. And the truth, anyway, is deliberately concealed from us. But it could be quite a serious shortfall.
Well, it could be. And, of course, I don't think we'll find that out until a moment of crisis. And then, well, we'll find something out. And we'll probably see that in rapidly rising prices. So we're at the end of our time. Thank you so much for your time. Very generous again. And how can people read you on a more regular basis?
Well, I have my own site, which is financeandeconomics.org. And I do a lot of writing for Gold Money, and that's is that really the Gold Money Foundation, but you can find them through goldmoney.com. That's James Turks. He's chairman of that. And, what we're trying to do is we're trying to educate people about the importance of sound money. It's not just gold and silver. There's got to be a future after all this. And
welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
If we're going to have any input, any valuable input in, as to how that future is going to transpire, then I think people have got to understand the virtues of sound money. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to educate people about that.
It's very worthwhile work. And of course, I do believe that we're going to need that sage counsel and advice and historical framework sooner than later.
Yes, no, I agree with you entirely. Yeah. But it's been a great pleasure for me to talk to you as well. And, we'll keep watching the situation.
Indeed we will. Thank you so much.
Not at all. My pleasure, Chris.
This concludes this podcast by Chris Martinson. To gain further insight into where things stand today and what might happen tomorrow, please visit chrismartinson.com. That's chrismartinson.com. Please join Chris Martinson next time to continue your journey toward awareness, understanding, and action.